And sleep is one of the best painkillers and mood busters out there and can prevent some pretty serious health problems. But many of us have a really precarious relationship with sleep. And also, if you have children, helping them to get enough shut eye can be a gigantic challenge. Dr. Sarah Blunden is a psychologist who's worked extensively in the field, communicating the importance of sleep while helping to diagnose and manage sleep problems in children and young people as well. And she joins me now. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Blunden.
Good afternoon, Julie. How are you?
Very well. And why is sleep so important for well-being and health?
Wow, how long have you got? I think, and I might be a bit biased, sleep is the foundation of all mental and physical health. In fact, if you think about it, without sleep, nothing goes right. So if you, the interesting thing is that we don't really know the true function of sleep, except that when we don't get it, all of our cognitive functions, our psychosocial functions, our capacity to interrelate to others, our ability to cope, our irritability, our behaviour, our physical well-being, the capacity to digest our food, as simple as that, all that can go really wrong if your sleep is not right. Having said that, we're pretty resilient. We can deal with the occasional bad night. But if it's, you know, chronically bad sleep, it's not a good thing.
And how about catching up on sleep? Is it possible? Can you go a few nights sleep of 4 hours and then catch up on the weekend?
You can, you know. That's really,
oh, really?
Interesting. The thing about sleep deprivation, we talk about last night I had a really bad night, but we will make up the sleep the next night. Not necessarily in duration, perhaps more in efficacy and efficiency. Our sleep is better, bigger, deeper, if you like. If we, for example, don't sleep one whole night, or we only sleep for 4 hours, as you suggested, then the next night you won't need to catch up the extra, say, 5 hours, hour for hour, because our body automatically kind of takes up a better, more efficient sleep. So we can catch up maybe one or two, and that will be sufficient for our bodies.
But it's not quite the same, is it, as having consistent, regular sleep?
It's not. And that's a really good point, because it's not just about the duration. It's about the constant regularity of sleep. So if we have 4 hours day one and 6 hours day two and 7 hours day three and then 4 hours back on day four, that's not good, because the body can't keep its rhythm. And we're all about rhythms. Our bodies are really about rhythms. And so when that rhythm gets distorted once or twice, that's okay. But on a constant and irregular basis, i.e. shift workers, unfortunately, particularly those that change shifts all the time, that is really tricky.
Is there anything that shift workers can do to make themselves more rested?
There are, and that's depending on the shift. It depends on how often they change shifts. I think probably in the literature that the worst shift is one that changes every 3 days, because our body sits into a kind of rhythm. It tries to make the rhythm happen. We can behaviorally make that rhythm happen with our light exposure, with our eating habits, with the times that we sleep or nap. But our body has an innate rhythm to sleep at night and work in the day. So that is very tricky. And we might just get into a rhythm and then we change shift again. And so our body has to readjust again. It's constantly in readjustment mode. It doesn't get a chance to settle, and that's not really great.
And if you don't get enough sleep over the course of your lifetime, it can actually have really huge ramifications further down the line, can't it?
It can, more so not because of the duration again, but because of the impact that sleep has on your body systems. So if your body systems, let's take, for example, your glucose metabolism system, which is really dysfunctional when sleep is dysfunctional. For example, if you don't sleep well, you're more likely to be obese, you're more likely to get diabetes because of the glucose metabolism. So let's just say that you're getting regular sleep for most of your life, then you're more likely to get diabetes because of that dysfunction to the system, as opposed to the fact that you've missed a few hours of sleep here and there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's not the sleep duration per se, because we can catch that up, in inverted commas, but it's the effect on the systems long term that maybe, as we get towards the end of our lives, that maybe our health is not so great because we haven't kind of done the great sleep thing in the beginning.
Dr. Sarah Blunden, psychologist and the founder and director of the Australian Centre for Education in Sleep, is with me. And a primary focus for you is children and young people. And from what I understand, the formative years are particularly important when it comes to getting enough sleep.
Absolutely. In a whole range of ways. Obviously, babies need to get sleep for growth. Our bodies stop growing clearly at about early adulthood, maybe 17, 18, but our brains keep going forever. Our bodies recharge at night. without sleep, our body systems can't function well enough in the daytime. So not only does our body grow and our brain grow, and therefore sleep needs that to happen, sleep is the driver of that. Sleep does a whole range of things when we're sleeping to our bodies. So clearly the formative years is very important. Mm-hmm. But also because our habits and the understanding of sleep, how we're taught about sleep, what we define sleep as important, and we're taught that socially and environmentally. So in a whole range of ways, the formative years are important for sleep hygiene, that is our behaviours around sleep, our learning of sleep behaviours, our understanding of how healthy our behaviours are, like anything else, like, you know, drinking water or exercising, eating the 5 and 2.
When I was a teenager, I rebelliously didn't want to go to bed. And I've still got a bit of that in me, but I appreciate the value of sleep more these days. But I didn't have a mobile phone with the world at my fingertips and a blaring screen. It must be really tough for teenagers these days.
Yes, I quite agree. And, you know, I think that there are two reasons why adolescents have problems with sleep. And one is physiological. There is actually a physiological delay in sleepiness in adolescents. Related to the puberty hormones, there's all this like hormone shifting goes on in adolescence, and one of them is the sleep hormone. So we have a tendency in adolescence to want to go to sleep later anyway. And we have so much else going on life that is so much more important than sleep, you know, people and friends and peers and boyfriends and work and the mobile phone and that social media will do it every time. And I do feel sorry for adolescents because I think that I try to think back to when I was in year 12, which is just a couple of years ago. And how stressful it was. And I guess year 12 is always, you know, adolescence is always stressful for everybody. But I think that they're under more stress than we were. And they are, as you say, it's available all the time. When I have adolescents who come into my clinic who have terrible sleep patterns and they're really struggling to get up to school and they're worried about their schoolwork and a whole range of flow-on effects, to try and get them to give up their phone is probably the hardest thing ever. And I'll tell you a little story. My daughter said to me, and she's much older now, but when she was a teenager, and I think she got her first phone at 14 or 15, which is probably pretty late these days. And later on in life, I said to her, so what was the worst thing I did, you know, to you as a parent, you know, in terms of discipline? She said, take my phone away at bedtime. Which I thought was pretty good. So I thought, you know, of all the times I told her she couldn't go out or she couldn't have this or she couldn't have that, the phone was the worst. So there you go. And that was a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
So I really do think that you're right. The phones are very important to them, and to get rid of them and to be connected with their mates and their peers at night time is a very big thing.
Mm, and now there are at least filters that you can put on your phone to make
correct.
It gets rid of the blue light.
Yes.
What else can you do? I mean, yeah, sure, you could take your children's phone away, but what sort of tips do you have for parents?
I think that we have to understand that it's a bit of a choice thing, obviously. I don't think adolescents or maybe young children would willingly give up their phone and go, yeah, this is great, I don't want my phone. It's really about, okay, the choice is if you give up your phone maybe a half an hour before you go to bed and replace it with something else that, okay, it's not as great, but what else could you do to stop that blue light. Now, you can put the filter on your phone, but it's not just the filter and the light. There are four reasons why the screen can be problematic. Well, there's the light. There's the content of what you're reading. Now, that content of what you're reading is clearly so important to you that you keep yourself awake. You wait for it to buzz. You're dying to find out what your girlfriend's saying or whatever's on TV or whatever the information is. Or it can be very detrimental and emotional. It can be really happy or really sad. So those are really, really important. And so they physiologically arouse the body, and the body and the mind have to be very calm to get to sleep. So that's also a very big problem. And thirdly, or fourthly, it is actually taking away, it's displacing sleep time, because while we're doing something else, we're not sleeping. Mm. So all of those reasons, not just the filter itself. So there, it really is, okay, the filter's great. And that's particularly good, I guess, for screens, because they're doing a lot of homework on screens. But I guess it's also about you need to be able to click off. Yeah, good luck with that one. Clicking off is really hard for them. And when we click off, and I heard a conversation about meditation just a little while back, and when we are able to keep our minds still, and that's, of course, hard to do, but when we are, lots of stuff comes flooding in. Why? Because there's room now. If it's full of information and we're doing stuff and we're busy and we're out and about, when we stop and we let that happen, stuff comes in because it can. Now, I kind of had this kind of image in my head of this empty bucket, and suddenly things come piling into the bucket as you're lying in bed at night, calm. it's very hard to keep that mind empty. And when you're a young kid, I guess that's even worse. So the calmness and the stillness is not a thing we do well in our society. That capacity to say, I can be okay with myself. I can be okay just lying here enjoying this nothing or this lovely piece of music or this nice hue or whatever it might be that's actually getting my body into a state of me as opposed to exterior stuff.
Yeah, we're really good at running away from ourselves and finding ways to ignore what's happening in our brains and trying to analyze what's happening in our lives. Dr. Sarah Blunden, as a psychologist, do you think there's any ways that we can try to, you know, channel in more time, try to give ourselves appointments for time with ourselves, perhaps not when we're trying to fall asleep?
Yeah, very good point. And I think that when we're trying to fall asleep and we're trying to fall asleep, we are trying. And so what the in adult sleep therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, for example, the trying to get to sleep is the worst thing you can do. And it's like trying to do anything. I'm going to try not to be nervous. Yeah. Well, of course, I'm going to be even more nervous. So I'm trying not to be nervous.
I find that I can't nap at all.
Yes.
Because I'm trying.
I'm the same. I know how to do it. I can do it. It just takes too long and I get impatient, essentially, is what's going on.
Right.
Some people can drop off really quickly. Some people can't. And that's okay. But it's when I have a set time and my schedule is tight, I don't think I can do it. Now, that's already inadvertently a stress around that nap.
Mm.
Because I want the nap and then I don't want the nap and then I think about the nap and I don't think about the nap. So it becomes a big thing. And it's the same as sleep time. So our capacity to be quiet, if you like, happening at nighttime is great, but unless we say, I must be quiet to get to sleep, as soon as there's a must or a should in that sentence, that becomes an imperative and that becomes an anxiety-provoking moment. Mm. So I think that what I try and do is to try and get people to be, particularly my clients, to sit, and you might even try it now, just sit and just be and just listen around you just for 5 seconds, and the capacity to just listen for 5 seconds to nothing or to listen to the leaves or the birds or the nothing is really very powerful, because, you know, when you do that, you can't be anxious because you can't listen and be anxious at the same time. And so I even have 8-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds doing this, because it just gives you a moment to go, ah, this is interesting. The thing is, I don't do much.
What are your thoughts on sleep medications?
Sleep medication is really effective. There's lots of research behind it. We have to be very careful when we... let me try that again. Sleep medication is very powerful in conjunction with other therapies, such as psychological therapy, to fix long-term sleep problems. Long-term sleep problems are usually, if they're insomnia and they're not physiological, they will have a psychological component to it. If it's really extreme... And as we said at the very outset of this conversation, sleep is the foundation of all health. So if your sleep is really bad and you're really so unwell that you can't function or you can't think and you're so stressed, it's going to take a while for that psychological therapy to kick in. So in which case, the most efficacious way to fix that is medication first, psychological therapy kicks in, psychological therapy keeps going, and the medication can be stopped. And that's been proven over and over again. And that's the same with many other also problems with health. But it certainly works with sleep.
So you want to wean off it?
You wean off it, yeah. Mm. Interestingly, many medications have got, are addictive, yeah. And so as a psychologist, someone might come into me and say, should I take medication, should I not take medication? And I'm not a medical doctor, so I couldn't prescribe that anyway. But I do know that the efficacy of the two together, and medication, sometimes I even recommend to some of my clients medication because they really are so unwell that they need a bit of a kick in. And we know that it's very effective provided it's taken carefully.
Mm. And what about the difference between, you know, just not being able to have a good night's sleep, maybe not setting up a good routine and having the mental headspace and actually having a really serious sleep disorder?
Yeah.
How can you tell the difference?
Yeah, very good point. So I guess the awareness of sleep, and conversations like this are great, the awareness of sleep is greater these days than it was maybe 10 years ago. And I think that people are understanding. Of course, they do immediately, because if you don't sleep, you feel instantly horrible, whereas if you don't eat the right food, you might feel horrible after a while. So it's very immediate. I think that people will try what they get on the net, what they look at, what Dr. Google says, or Mrs. Smith around the corner, or parents-in-law. They'll take all that information, they'll try it, and if it doesn't work, then they're going to head off to the GP. GPs are more attuned these days, and we get a lot of collaboration between the medical profession and the psychological profession now, particularly since we have psychological services, which are Medicare reimbursed, which is fabulous, to be able to work together to get those sleep problems fixed up. And the first thing that I would do to any of my clients or any of the people that consult with me is you need to go and get a medical checkup. I did my PhD in a hospital, so I can screen for that, but we need to make sure that we're working together, not separately. So the medical profession will screen at anything that will be a medical sleep disorder, and then I will take over for any behavioural or non-medical, I guess.
So not everyone is aware of sleep hygiene. What are a few tips within that, you know, realm, I suppose?
Okay. Yeah.
To get a good night's sleep.
Yeah. It's a funny word, sleep hygiene, isn't it? I guess hygiene is about being well and being clean, really, is what we initially thought. So sleep hygiene is the behaviours around sleep that we can manipulate that can make sleep good or not good. So, for example, if you were to drink a caffeinated drink close to bedtime, that has the likelihood of staying in your system for a while and therefore keeping you awake. But, you know, some people can drink coffee at 11 o'clock at night and hit the pillow and go straight to sleep. I can't have coffee after now, which is a shame, because I won't sleep until 2 o'clock in the morning.
And decaf's not the same.
And decaf is certainly not the same, no. So being aware of what keeps your body alert, caffeine, drugs, cigarettes, being aware of the fact that alcohol will make you very drowsy and put you to sleep because it's a sedative, but it does not keep you asleep because your body goes into reaction halfway through the night, so your sleep will be worse once you've got to sleep and woken up.
So if you use booze to go to sleep, it's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea. It puts you to sleep, and that's good. I guess that's good. When you're having trouble, it's often a self-medicator, but it's not good long-term, of course, for a whole range of reasons. What else? So there's a screen. We've talked about the screens. We've talked about keeping your bedtime the same-ish, so that we're not crazily changing our routine and our wake time. And that's okay if you work. That's okay if you work regularly. If you're a shift worker, that's tricky. We've talked about the type of food that you might eat at dinner time. If you're going to have a spicy hot jalapeno pizza at 11 o'clock at night, that's going to be tricky.
How many hours before sleeping should you eat?
For an adult, it's somewhere in the 2 to 3 hour realm is the healthiest. Interestingly, for children, they will these days have dinner 5:30, 6 o'clock, and they're in bed at 7:30. So, yes, they have different amounts of food that they've eaten, but they still digest, must digest quicker. It's interesting.
And then one other thing, isn't there? There's with sleep hygiene, there's trying to just use your bed for sleep and obviously intimate relations.
Yes, yes.
You can't cut that out. That's an important part of it too, isn't it? Not doing, you know, homework and things like that on your bed. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think about that rule, and I think that's really, if you have a problem getting to sleep in your bed, then we need to keep bed for activity so that our body and our mind has a preconceived notion that when we hit our bed, we are in the process of going into sleep mode. It's a whole behaviour pattern that we create or is created. If you haven't got a sleep problem and you read in your bed, or you do your work in bed or not, and you go straight to sleep, I don't see the problem.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing about sleep hygiene and about sleep disorders. There's a whole range of information out there. If it's not a problem for you, it's not a problem for you. Well, of course, if you're not sleeping really, you know, 4 hours for your entire life, that may not be great. But, you know, apparently Churchill make the right decisions, I don't know. And apparently Thatcher did too, so you can decide what you want to say about that one too. But, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is it's not a problem until it's a problem. So if you want to use your computer or read a book and it works for you, you're right, that is the rule. But I kind of wonder about rules that we take on board without thinking about it.
Yeah, true. We'll have to leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you for joining me, Dr.
That's
Sarah Blondin.
Thank you.
Psychologist and founder and director of the Australian Centre for Education in Sleep.